You're listening to Practical Defense with Alex Haddix.
Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Haddix, and this is episode 207, Kevlar with Doc Wesson, Part 1. This week, we have another special guest. Doc Wesson of the Gun Nation podcast joins us to talk about Kevlar vests. Doc is a PhD chemist and also works in the development and application of Kevlar, both for civilian and military applications. The interview with Doc ran a little long, so I had to break it into two parts. So this week, we'd have part one. But before we get into the discussion, I have a few quick updates about my book. First, thanks to Nikki and Davina, my book has been accepted into the University of Central Florida Library. This is a really big deal. Libraries are particular about what they carry because there's a lot of maintenance around cataloging and tracking the books, not to mention shelf space. This is a really big honor for me, and I greatly appreciate that Nikki and Davina took the time to take on that task. I didn't even know they were going to do it. They just let me know after it was all done. So, thanks again. Also, my book is doing really well on the Kindle store. My ranking bounces between 72,000 and 35,000. They update the numbers every hour, and it fluctuates greatly, but I generally stay in that range. Also, I know these numbers sound like they're really large, but considering that there are 800,000 titles in the Kindle store, that means my book is in the top 4 to 9%. That is just amazing and beyond anything I ever expected to achieve with my first book. I'm only in there because you guys are buying it and spreading the word. So thanks to all of you for making that happen. Now, I would compare my numbers to Masoud Ayoub's new book in the Kindle store, but that just wouldn't be fair. Yeah, it wouldn't be fair to me. He's in the top 0.5%. I prostrate myself before the master. And finally, the Gun Rights Radio Network has a new monthly newsletter. It's a great way to keep abreast of what's going on with the network, scheduled events, meetups, show summaries, and Second Amendment issues. It's professionally formatted, and I like it as a means to find out what the other shows in the network are talking about. With all the other amazing program available in the network, it's useful to pick up the shows and the topics that I may have missed. Okay, let's get on to the discussion. So we'll be right back with Doc Wesson on the subject of Kevlar.
The legal aftermath of using a gun in self-defense can be traumatic and expensive. Get help and peace of mind through the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Network members receive much-needed financial and legal support right after a self-defense incident. They also receive education in the form of DVDs from some of the top names in the business, along with having access to a nationwide pool of attorneys. Learn about membership at www.armedcitizensnetwork.org.
Welcome back. Now this week, we have a great guest. We have Doc Wesson of the Gun Nation podcast, and he's actually one of the first podcasters on the Gun Rights Radio Network. And you also might remember his other show, the Barstool Discussions, that he does with Mark Vanderberg. So thanks for coming on the show, Doc.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me, Alex. Real honored to be here.
Well, you and I first had this, we're talking about this discussion and talking about having you on the show almost a year ago. So it's really my fault for being such a lazy bum. Not having you on the show and actually getting this stuff set up. And even when we talked about it again, it still took me another 6 weeks to set it up.
I guess so. You just had to decide whether you really wanted me or not.
I just appreciate your patience.
No problem at all. Glad to be here.
Now, the reason why we're having you on the show is that you, as most people won't know, are an expert in Kevlar. Doc is not just a nickname. Doc is actually a degree. You actually have a pilot high and deep degree in polymer science. Can we call you a chemist as well?
Yeah.
Would that be appropriate?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay.
I've been called worse.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about Kevlar and Kevlar vests and get a little bit about your background. Mm-hmm. I'll let you do that because it's kind of wide and varied. Now, one thing I will tell the audience is that we're going to be a little obtuse with Doc's background because of what he works and where he works and what he does. He's under contract.
Under NDA. Mm-hmm.
And non-disclosure agreements. And so he really can't go into a lot of specifics on the air very publicly about what he does and who he works for. Mm-hmm. So we're going to kind of dance around that a bit. Trust me, he knows his stuff. So he is an expert in the field at the highest levels. So we'll just leave it at that. And so, Doc, tell us what you can about yourself.
Well, I paid my $10 and they gave me this shingle that said foot on it. And I couldn't. It's spelt funny, though. Anyway.
That internet spelling with uppercase and lowercase.
Yeah, that's
characters.
What it is. No, but I did study polymer chemistry or polymer science as well. Did that at the great university, North Carolina State University. And I basically worked in my background in previous to what I'm doing now, which I've been doing for about 15 years. In coatings, decoding type chemistries. I've dabbled in filtration for products such as oil filtration. I've worked with companies like Wix and Purolator and helped develop some products there for them. And ended up getting into the company I'm at now. And we ended up doing a lot of industrial type textiles. And we don't not just weave them or, you know, put the fabrics together. It's more of a materials type science, I guess. And we, of course, produce glass type materials, glass fabrics, and, of course, Kevlar. And that's, obviously been really popular, throughout the wars we've had recently and ongoing as well. But, started in that and actually work with companies such as DuPont, for instance, that we try to actually not just – we don't make the Kevlar or make the fiber. We actually weave it, of course, but we try to make it better by, adding materials to it, certain treatments and the like, which obviously that's where we're going to have to kind of leave it gray. But but it's been a lot of fun. There's a lot to it. And it's overall very interesting. It changes constantly and there's always problems with it and there's always issues, but then there's always good successes as well. So it's been rewarding just to be able to be involved with it. But that's kind of how I got into the whole thing, and we've produced materials. Actually, you've gone into government, things such as SCOTUS, Supreme Court. I worked with them for a while to try to produce like panels for podiums. And then, of course, a lot of the materials. Some folks don't realize, but armament such as S-glass. If you look at the bottom of some of the Stryker vehicles and some of the other vehicles that are in theater, you will actually those would be glass underneath, a set in resin, and they're very strong. And so that's also armor material is glass as well. So it's not just aramid fabrics like Kevlar.
Okay, so you just lost me there. So when we're talking about those various substrates, we're talking about military vehicles that are coated on the bottom with, did you really say glass?
Mm-hmm. It's not coated with glass. It's glass fabrics.
Glass fabrics. And why wouldn't you just use like steel?
Well, because
old-fashioned American steel.
Well, because it's lighter. You can get much better strength out of it, and it's lighter. And of course, there's cost issues as well, depending on what the level of protection that they want to have, depending on what they want. But everything right now is geared towards the weight, because over there, speed is everything, and that's not just with all the heavy equipment. That's also with the material that the soldier carries as well. It's very important. Is the weight issue.
That I understand. And what I'd like to focus the discussion on today is not so much the military applications,
right,
but civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's had a class with Masada Yu, one of the things that he recommends is that anybody who was a designated defender of the household should have a vest.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things he advocates. And you keep it, under your bed right next to your home defense item.
Mm-hmm.
And
The other thing is private security. Those guys need vests too, because they come up across a lot of different things, not just bullets, but they're also something we're going to talk about are stab vests. So, but before we get into the specifics of the different products, tell us about what Kevlar is. I mean, I know, ever think everyone understands that it's a fabric.
It is a fabric.
So let's talk about, because I've seen some shows and they talk about layering and stitching and crossing and is it put together like plywood? Could you kind of go into that for us, please?
Sure, you bet. Kevlar itself is actually a polyamide. It's or para-aramid is what they also call it. It's a synthetic fiber, of course, and it's not dissimilar to nylon. Nylon is very similar to it. Now, Kevlar was actually discovered pretty much by accident. And DuPont, of course, they're the big boys. They had they were the ones that basically came out with the ability to, you know, produce it. And it was a lady named Stephanie Kowalik that was I think she had a B.S. in chemistry. It was back in the 40s that she got her B.S. But she basically first synthesized it in about mid-60s, I believe it was, in the DuPont laboratories over in Wilmington, Delaware. And basically what makes Kevlar, I guess, different from like a nylon. And if you'll recall, that there are nylon vests. That was a precursor to Kevlar, was a nylon vest. They call them flak vests, is the fact that the – and I'll try not to be too chemistry here – But basically what it amounts to is the chain of the molecule for Kevlar, the aramid itself, is very long and intrinsically stiff. And because of that, you get a lot of molecular binding of the molecules, which causes friction of the molecules and other varying types of forces that keep the molecules together. So in the length direction of Kevlar, it's absolutely just, I forgot, was it 10 times stronger than steel, basically, in that amount. And maybe not be quite that much, but it's very strong. But you look at the strength of Kevlar versus the weight versus steel, it is a no-brainer. Kevlar, of course, is stronger and much, much, much lighter. Now, Kevlar, what I like to use as an example, if you take twine, two pieces of twine, and you stretch them out, say, a foot, side by side, and then you take the two pieces of twine and you twist them together to make one yarn, and then you designate on each end which twine is which and pull the opposite twine, not the same one, you can pull them apart. But if you do that for a mile and twist it, you'll never get the two apart because the amount of friction is there. And that's basically what Kevlar does. It's intrinsically stiff, very long chain molecules. And that's how that works. It's very hard. And we were kidding at the very beginning before we started the recording. We talked about it being the yellow fiber. It you don't really dye it. There's a solution dye method that DuPont, I think, pretty much owns the rights to about how to get the color into it. But most of the time, you see the yellow, you know it's Kevlar. But that probably is one of the largest, you know, I guess, protective fibers on the market today, obviously, with DuPont being as big as they are. And pretty much the first one that came out. There's other ones out there as well that you see that incorporates liquid crystal polymers, such as like the Tuorons and some of the other things like that. But Kevlar's the big boy, really. It's been around about the longest, and they do a good business with it at DuPont, and are constantly changing things. You had mentioned not just ballistics, but also vests for stab protection, and which is very strange because Kevlar fabric is really not good for puncture resistance.
Yeah, so that's how I discovered that you even worked with the fibers, is that I was doing some research for stab vests, and of course I went to the network to say, hey guys, you know, I'm doing some research for, you know, a security guard contract that I'm going to be teaching and things like that. And I wanted to find out about stab vests, and a bunch of people chimed in and I got an email from you and saying, yeah, I work with the stuff. I help design it. I'm like, and you said, and then you were telling me, yeah, Kevlar is actually better for knives than it is for guns and bullets. And I'm like, you're kidding me. So why? What are the properties of Kevlar that make it better for slashes than than bullets and piercing, like a
well,
because I've seen a lot of gloves that talk about Kevlar, you know,
right.
as for cooking as well as tactical gloves
mm-hmm.
for slashing, for handling people with knives and things. And I was like, what? Why would why wouldn't it just cut it?
Yeah, it's the thing about Kevlar. It's highly abrasive resistant. So, you know, one good example of a product that you would see in the market, of course, albeit a high-end product, is Kevlar, chaps that they have for motorcycle riders. You know, what would happen is you hit the ground and you can, I wouldn't recommend it, but you slide and basically can come up and the Kevlar does not look, that eat up. I mean, it's really good for abrasion type resistance, for slashing. And again, it's due to that intrinsically stiff, molecule in there. It's very hard to break it. Now, the problem with the ballistic part of it is, with fabrics, you have the typical like plain woven fabrics. You have what they call a warp and a fill, and I won't get into all that. But it's the warp runs in the long direction, the fill runs in the short direction across the width of the fabric. And you have, as it goes, the fill goes through a tunnel, which we call a shed, and it goes up and down and up and down. You have knuckles, and in those knuckles, it's the weak link. That's the weak point because it's not straight. That's where you actually would have crimping or, pressing. Down into the interstices, which is the hole of the fabric, that's also another weak spot. So if you shoot, say, a bullet, or if you have a better example would be to use like a shiv or an ice pick. You want to, if you come down with that with force, it's going to find the hole of that fabric very easily because, once again, the fiber is extremely strong. It's just going to move out of the way for the ice pick to find the hole. And of course, since it's abrasion resistant, it's slick, and it'll that the point of the shiv would fall right off of the fiber and go right into the interstices of the fabric, or once again the hole. And so they're extremely bad for puncture resistance. But again, very strong as far as slashing, very strong as far as abrasion. And again, that's one of the reasons why you have them in gloves. You have them in other, apparel for anything that would call for, I guess if you're going to fall or such as what I used as an example, the motorcycle chaps. That actually became fairly big at one point because, you fall off and the Kevlar's not showing. It's actually underneath the main fabric, the outside fabric. And then, of course, the outside fabric goes away as you're, grinding it on the pavement or whatever it is, and basically it gets to the Kevlar, and it should come up pretty good for you. So that's really the reason why it's better, again, is because of the intrinsically stiff nature of the molecule.
So you make it sound like it's not good for bullets at all.
Well, that's why, and a lot of people think that you take one layer of fabric and that would be bulletproof. Oh, first, let me get that out of the way. Bulletproof should not be in the vernacular because really there's no such thing as proof. If you stand between someone shooting at you and 50 feet of concrete, that's more proof than I – but still, you never know. I mean, so really bulletproof should not be in the vernacular because it really is – we like to call it bullet resistant. It does help. But there's no guarantees 100% that, there's not going to be an issue with something going through. With a bullet, if you look at some of the handgun bullets, for instance, they have a broader surface area on the face of the bullet, especially with like a hollow point, for instance, more so than with a full metal jacket. The hollow point itself has got a lot of surface area. And then, of course, when it hits, it opens up and creates more surface area.
Yeah, mushroom.
Now, right, exactly. So what that does is it disperses the force amongst a group of the fibers. So it's not just finding the interstices or the hole of the fabric. It really spreads it out overall. Well, a lot of people will call in saying, I want to make this out of Kevlar so it'll be bulletproof. And that's really not how it works. It takes a number of plies depending on what your threat is you want to stop or what we call a threat level. And so you want to really pay attention to, how many plies that you would put in, the type of of fiber it is. I mean, because you don't just – there's not just one yarn. There's many different types of yarn, different types of what we call denier, which is the actual width of the yarn. And there's different uses for all that. For instance, in a puncture resistant material, again, it takes plies, and it just depends on how many plies you want for what threat level for puncture that you want to resist. Typically, in that you have, and I don't want to give away the farm here, but you basically want to have kind of some small fibers that are really packed in tight, because then you don't have a whole lot of area for that thing to find the hole. There's not a whole lot of hole there for it to go through. So really, that's the whole idea behind the puncture resistant stuff.
But doesn't that make it stiffer and more like a board rather than a nice pliable fabric like a silk?
Mm-hmm. It does. You're right, and that's why you'll typically, and well, in my opinion, you'll see the stab proof stuff being a whole lot smaller as far as the panel itself goes versus, you know, like the bullet resistant type panels. And then of course now, and something that I'm involved with is trying to find things that are interlayer between the layers that will actually help reduce the weight and protect, Kevlar's not cheap. It's very expensive, and maybe help reduce the cost while improving the resistance of it. So there's a lot of polymers that go in between that you could possibly put in between layers. But once again, you're right. It ends up trying to stiffen it up. It does stiffen it, but once again, it's a fairly lightweight fabric at that point. You've got a lot of packed fibers in there, but keep in mind, again, the fibers are very small compared to what would be seen, say, in a bullet-resistant type vest. And then, of course, when you stack the and you mentioned a little while ago how you put them together, such as the sewing or, whatever. Basically, if you don't have a complete consolidation of each layer, it's not as stiff. So the less consolidation of each layer, the better off you are as far as the flexibility of it goes. So there's a whole lot of things that come into play, and it's all give and take. It's just like, we talk about guns. You've got concealment. And, you want to conceal a gun that's small. It's got a small barrel. Well, of course, you give up velocity when you have a small barrel, and you also give up weight, so you've got more report and recoil. It's the same thing with this. There's gives and takes in it. You and I were talking earlier. You don't normally see your average security officer walking through a mall with an interceptor vest on, which has got, all the Kevlar layers along with the ceramic panels in it. I mean, that would be ridiculous to think that would be needed. Well, who knows? Well, I can't really say that these days. But
you don't live in Los Angeles.
No, well, that's true. That's true. But the thing about it is, it's not as practical. Let's put it that way. As far as the comfort and the ability to put it on, because it's like anything. The more difficult it is to don something, the more likely you're not going to want to do it. And the whole idea is to find that right mix where you're comfortable, it's still flexible enough, but you've got a level of protection there.
Let's bounce off that and go into the manufacturing process, if we can, a little bit. Because all my experience with Kevlar comes from watching the Discovery Channel. And I've seen them in the manufacturing plants, and they're literally just counting out layers and mm-hmm. putting them into a sewing machine and sewing them into a form, and then they're putting them mm-hmm. into some sort of nylon jacket.
Bag.
Yeah.
Yep.
Some sort of something like that.
Exactly.
And Doc and I actually spoke for a full hour before we even started recording. But you were saying that there are complications that may happen during the manufacturing process, and there was actually one. Well, let's save that for a little bit after we talk about the manufacturing process, some of the errors that can be introduced and some very mm-hmm. famous and high-profile errors that were introduced.
Sure. Well, as far as the – and, of course, when we produce the material, like I said, we weave the fabric and, of course, treat it if it needs to be treated, depending on what the customer wants. And I get tickled because a lot of times we'll have these customers, which are the folks that are actually putting the vest together, would call up, or a potential – before doing that, we'll call up and say, hey, what do I need to do? What should I buy to make a vest stop a 357 magnet or, something like that? I'm just using that as a blind example. But it's like we can't really sit and tell them what to do because there's many, many different ways to combine the materials to get the threat level that you want. then, of course, once they get it, we don't know what they're doing with it afterwards. And there's so many different techniques that I've seen with people trying to consolidate these vests. And you're quite right. They'll have the squares or panels, as we call them, and put up the number of prescribed plies depending on what the threat level is they're trying to protect against. And in some cases, they may stitch in certain type patterns across the face of it, or they may just stitch around the edge of it. And that right there also makes a difference in, you know, how it performs the protection. But once again, it also stiffens it up the more that you actually, you know, consolidate the layers together, because there's not that slide, there's not that give there. But there's without, again, giving the farm away, and of course, I'm not really the expert in, we've actually tested that to try, you know, the patterns of sewing and things of such to try to help or help send in a direction our customers, you know, something that they could maybe make a better product out of. But once again, that's left up to them, because, you know, we try to, you know, help them out as much as possible by doing that. But again, that becomes their claim to fame at that point as well. But there are some issues, you know, like when they sew it, it's, you know, again, it can be tough on the needles. There can be some issues with, you know, abrasion. And again, it's very abrasive resistant material, but you know, there's still things that could happen to it. And anytime something happens, it becomes kind of a weak link. But the companies that are out there that are notable, reputable, those are the ones that have really got the process down, and you know who they are. I mean, you'll hear the words Point Blank and PACA, a lot of these other companies like that. But there was a time when a lot of mom and pop companies, and it wasn't that long ago, were actually trying to put together material like that and actually being able to sell it. And so what happened was they came around with the NIGA, came around with some standardized testing.
Okay. Could you go over who the NIGA is?
Oh, yeah. NIGA is the National Institute of Justice. It's the government, NIGA. And they are the ones that actually have the numbers that you have to certify by. And we'll just briefly, if it's okay with you, Alex, we'll just talk about threat levels. We've talked about threat levels. And
yeah, if you look at the ads for any of these types of things, mm-hmm. in Gauss magazine or something like that, you'll see threat level like 2, you know, IIA or 2A, 2, mm-hmm. 3A, you know, they're all different types here. They're all different costs, different mm-hmm. weights. And the prices range from, you know, $325 up to $700.
Yeah, it gets expensive. Mm-hmm. So, depending on what they are.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So could you demystify that for us? Tell us what those actually
mean. Sure.
Of course, they don't explain it in the catalog. They just say, you know, this version is this price and this version is this price. And it's like, so what's the difference?
Yeah. Well, it does make a difference. First off, the NIGA tests are typically performed at approved independent labs. And the one that I use a lot is called H.P. White, and they're in Maryland. They're probably the biggest one. They're used the most, and as far as I know, they're used the most. So what happens is these threat levels are basically listed out in caliber and weight of bullets. And yes, we're talking about just, you know, everything from a 22 mag to a 38 to a 357 to a 45 ACP, and of course different weights. They even include you know, in their testing, the length of barrel, and basically it gives you a velocity. Now, what they try to do to actually get a panel of fabric tested out is to obtain what they call a V50, and a V50 is where 50% of the projectiles penetrate and 50% of the projectiles fired don't penetrate. And so that V50 is what they go off of, and that's how they can determine basically what the number of plies would be for the threat level. Now, the threat level itself, you mentioned their threat level 2, 2A, that kind of thing. I don't think now, we don't really dabble much in it, but it used to be a threat level 1. There may still be. I don't hear much about that anymore. But typically, threat level 1 included like a 22, and at the low end, 22 caliber, like a 40 grain long rifle, all the way up to basically the 38 caliber 158 grain semi wad cutter. and list in velocities, like the 22 caliber was at 1,050 feet per second, and then all the way to the 38 special, 850 feet per second. So what that means is you're supposed to be able to protect that particular round at that speed with that vest, with that threat level, that level vest. And
but,
of course,
only 50% of the time.
No. Those numbers were based on the original count to put the plies together for the threat level. So it actually, those numbers are below that. So it's not saying, oh, you got to flip a coin and it's going to hopefully come up on the edge, yeah. You know. So it's not like that. No, these would be tested out at that point. The original development of it, you get the V50 out of, and that's how you determine. And it's basically using the same thing to get the threat levels, but that's how you determine what you're going to put as far as the type of fabric, the number of layer fabrics in there to get the test threat level done. So once you've done that, then you take it and you shoot it. And basically every time they shoot it, when they certify it, it will come up to where it stops at each time. So that way they can say this, you know, is a threat level blah. And, you know, you can feel comfortable knowing that that's the threat it should stop. It's rated to stop those numbers. And the threat levels, like we mentioned, one, I think they've done away with that because you don't really hear much about that anymore.
I didn't even see it listed in the catalog.
Yeah. It's probably been done away. Threat level 2A, which is 22 mag, 40 grain, solid point. Now, it's at 1,180 feet per second. And then that goes through the various calibers, 38 caliber, 125 grain plus P's. 45 caliber, 230 grain ball, jacketed saw point for 158 grain, 357 magnum. And believe it or not, the 9mm are, they're wicked. I mean, you got them incorporated in there in the mix with the 357 magnum. And you think, well, my gosh, you know, typical 357 magnum is very high speed. But typically the 9mm ball ammo is, you know, it penetrates. It penetrates immensely. And so, that's
a big hunk of lead.
It really is, and it's slick with that full metal jacket. You know, it's ball, so it's not pointed, but it definitely has got less surface area on flat contact than say the jacketed soft points and the semi wide cutters and the hollow points. Then of course that 2A goes up to like a 10mm, 200 grain full metal jacket at like over 1,000, about 1,100 feet per second, I think. Then you get in the 2As, and then the level two is actually higher than the 2A. It's 44 mag, 210 grain soft point, and then believe it or not, the 9mm, 124 grain full metal jacket. That's the one I was telling you about. So you've got a 41 mag, 200 grain soft point being equal in threat level to a 9mm, 124 grain full metal jacket, the ball ammo. And once again, that's based on penetration of a ball ammo.
Which also speaks to the point why the 9mm ball ammo overpenetrates.
Exactly.
Why everyone talks about going hollow points because you don't overpenetrate with it.
Exactly right. Perfect example of what 9mm ball, you hear that all, and that was what I was going to bring up, was the fact that, you know, it really does penetrate a lot. you know, it's you know, the speed that they list for the 124 grain full metal jacket for the 9mm is 1,175 feet per second. Well, you know, you've got 357 magnums going, you know, 1,500. You know, of course, they list it in the 2A. Let's see here. Let's say the 158 grain is at 1,250, you know, so that's already, you know, faster, you know, than the level two, which is higher, of the 124 grain full metal jacket for 9mm. But once again, it's all based on the surface area of the projectile. So you're right. You're exactly right. There, 9mm will penetrate. It will absolutely penetrate. There's no doubt about it. Of course, then there's the level 3A, which is a big boy. It's a 44 mag, gas checked, 240 grain semi wide cutter. Nominal speeds on that's 1,400 feet per second. And then there's some other various and sundry. Well, once again, the 9mm, 124 grain full metal jacket at 1,400 feet per second. So the same thing in a 9mm speed for a much lighter weight bullet for the same threat level as the 44 mag and a 240 grain bullet. And that one is a big test that I use a lot based on, like we did for the cockpit panel doors, we did for planes and all, which of course were Kevlar as well. But and then of course they've got other various and sundry rounds in there that people may or may not be familiar with, like a 9mm Norma, 9mm Lapua. So there's 9mm Israel is another one. So there's some different ones in there as well. And then, of course, the threat level 3. And once you start getting out of the 3As, you're really starting to kind of get into the military, more military-type things, because you're looking at or heavy law enforcement, I guess, maybe with SWAT, possibly. Because once you get into threat level 3, you know, you're really starting to incorporate the ceramic vests, I mean, panels with that. The threat levels there would stop a 7.62 NATO ball, so that's a 308.
Yeah.
You know, at 150 grains, going like 2,700 feet per second. So huge, huge difference. There's an enormous leap there. And then, of course, threat level 4 is the highest one. That's your big boy. And that's, 30-06, 166 grain bullet, armor pierce with 2,850 feet per second. So, you know, I don't want to get hit with anything, but holy smokes.
Yeah. But so we're moving away from handgun ammunition and we're talking about rifle rounds.
Right.
Which is
right.
A totally different category.
Right. That's again, more into the military and the high end law enforcement, big boys. Yeah.
So basically the bigger the number, the greater the protection, but also we're going to look at increased weight and increased thickness with decreased flexibility.
Exactly. And ergo comfort too. So
we're going to get into that in a minute or so here.
Yeah.
So in terms of stab vests,
mm-hmm.
do they only need the level 2 or 2A?
Well, the stab vests are totally different. Stab vest goes through like level 1, 2, and 3. And again, what I'll do is I'll give you a link if you want to put it up on your website or something, because it's very, you have to actually read it to get a really good idea, because basically, the way those things, it's not really like taking, say, a 30-57 Magnum 110 grain bullet and, you know, comparing it to a, it's totally different. It's a pointed, like an ice pick or shiv, based on a force behind it with a weight. So it's really hard for me to say, okay, this would be the same as somebody jabbing you in the back with an ice pick. I mean, because you can't really, can't really say that. But it gives you ideas, you know, based on that. So really there's only like, unless I'm mistaken, there's only like 3 levels of the stab protection. And that's totally different, complete separate from the NIJ ballistic ones.
Okay. So it's a different rating system, different categories.
Correct. Set by the same people though.
Okay. Yeah. Because in most of the catalogs, they don't even talk about the stab. They all talk about just ballistics and the bullets and things.
Right. Two separate products altogether. Now we're starting to look at, one of the things I'm looking at is actually incorporating the two of them. What can you do to get stab as well as get ballistic protection as well? That's some of the things we're starting to look at.
Right. Because you're probably going to face a knife more often than a gun.
Mm-hmm.
They're just more common. They're more ubiquitous, especially if you're looking at like in Europe, you know, where there are stricter gun laws. The knife violence is far greater than it is here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still, you know, plenty of violence to go around, and there is gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
But knives are far, far more common in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So is there one that does both? Or do you have to get one to each specific task?
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, I imagine that there are some people out there actually selling it based on the fact that they can do both. But, you know, I don't really see a lot of, you know, people coming out just advertising specific on it. And again, that's one of the things I'm kind of looking at now, is trying to get something that's got maybe good inner layer treatment along with the proper amount of strength, tensile strength for the fabrics to be ballistically protected as well. So I imagine there are some out there touting that they sell. I don't really know of any. to be quite honest with you, because the real big boy is the ballistic thing, and that primarily was due based to the – and again, we're getting away from the individual thing, but for the military and the tight. So the stab-resistant stuff really is really starting to come – I'd say within the past 5-6 years, it really started to come on a lot stronger. So that's one of the things, like I say, we're kind of looking on as trying to get a full solution for both.
Because it also is just thinking corrections officers are far more likely to get shivved than they are shot.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where that's the big one for going into the stab protection. As a matter of fact, the NIJ, their pamphlet that they put out each year based on the protection, it calls it law enforcement correction standards. That's what they call it for the stab resistance. And so that's absolutely correct. That's exactly where they're targeting it. And of course, that's going to be, I think, a lighter weight, a little more. It's going to be not a little. It's going to be a lot more flexible as well. If you see one of the stab protective products versus one of the ballistic protective products, you'd know exactly which one was the stab.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm also thinking probably school security would also probably be a really good point.
Yes, absolutely. 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 Good point. Good point. And like you say, you know, it's that to me seems like it would be really a lot bigger as far as, like you say, the civilian type markets there, those types of protective markets. Absolutely.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro Second Amendment, pro gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Thanks again to Doc for coming on the show. We'll have the second part of the discussion in the next full episode, which should be in about 2 weeks. Until then, you can hear more from Doc on the Gun Nation podcast and the GRN Barstool discussions. Now, coming up on the show, we also have an interview with Gila Hayes. Gila is an author and self-defense instructor. She shares her insight and experiences on women-specific defense issues. I have that interview already recorded, and we'll get it out after the second part with Doc. But that will do it for this week. As always, you can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I'm Practical Def, and Facebook is Practical Defense. I also invite you to check out my book on practical home security. It's currently available in DeadTree, commonly known as paperback, Kindle, Nook, and iTunes editions. Autographed copies are available on my website, and that URL is alexhaddix.com/book. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. You can also leave us a voicemail on the new Practical Defense tip and comment line at 805-203-6586. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe.
Hey everybody, we are
Lady Antebellum.
Before every show, we practice. Gotta be prepared.
Exactly, and the American Red Cross wants us to be prepared too. Prepared for disaster.
Just take 3 steps to be Red Cross ready. Create a disaster supplies kit with water, food, and a first aid kit. Make a family communication plan and listen to local radio and TV reports to stay informed.
It's that simple. To learn more, visit redcross.org or contact your local Red Cross chapter today. Thank you so much.
Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense podcast. For questions, commentary, tips, or topic suggestions, send us an email at podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 805-203-6586. I look forward to hearing from you.
Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can now hear Gun Rights Radio Network while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources